on AM and FM around the UK, on digital and online. I'm Rod Sharp, and we're up all night. The hit song of early 1917 in the USA was I Didn't Raise My Boy to Be a Soldier. This month's centenary of the American entry into World War I has been mainly low-key, with commemorative pieces appearing in local newspapers. Part of the reluctance to make a fuss may stem from the fact that Americans are fighting at least one foreign war, but this was, says our next guest, the real starting point of the American century. More Americans died in these 2 years than in Korea and Vietnam combined. One of them, sadly, was a member of the journalist Patrick Gregory's extended family. But what he left behind in his long and detailed letters was a remarkable historical archive now written up in An American on the Western Front, the book that Patrick Gregory has co-written with his mother-in-law, Elizabeth Nurser. Here is his story of how he became involved with Private Arthur Clifford Kimber.
As soon as I open my mouth, I'm going to tell the audience that I'm not American. And I am a journalist, and I have worked in London most of my career. My mother-in-law, Elizabeth, happens to be American, and she had held on all these years to a family archive which had been put in boxes in attics and garages and spare rooms in California and Oregon, and laterally over the last 15-20 years it's been over here in the UK. And as we were approaching our own centenary in the war back in 2013-14, I thought the time really had arrived for us to do something in time for the American anniversary in 17. And so I said, you've wanted to get these letters seen and heard by a wider public. Do you want to cooperate? So that's exactly what we did.
I think it has to be said straight off that these are not of the kind of hello, Mum, all doing well here, you know, had a little break the other day, went for a swim, you know, your loving son. They're very much fuller than that, aren't they? This man is incredibly articulate.
What is interesting about the archive, and what attracted me about them, was the completeness of them. Historically, they're interesting because we're not aware that as complete an archive of American letters from World War I exists. He wrote these letters from the moment he left home in California in April 17, a couple of weeks after America went into the war, until the night before his death in the autumn of 18. So he spans 18 of the 19 months of American involvement. Now, those letters that you say, which are very full, very long and detailed and very engaging, he's a Stanford undergraduate. He left just before graduating from Stanford University in California. He wrote these letters at a rate of 2 or 3 per week, every week for these 18 months. So what you get is really quite an immediate picture, a real picture, first of all, of America as he travels across America by train, then across the Atlantic, through England. He arrives in Liverpool, travels through England, sees wartime London. So you get a fresh pair of eyes, American eyes as well, from an outside perspective, on what America, yes, but then what England, what France looked like 3 years into the First World War. He's taking the first official American flag to the front, but he takes that to France, and there the rest of the narrative unfolds.
I think he's exceptional because he is out there on campus in Stanford, and he obviously comes from a family that have been quite well-to-do. His father was a minister before his untimely death. And the family move out from New York to California. And there is a legacy, which is an interesting preoccupation throughout the letters, because he wants his mother well looked after. But he's kind of ahead of his time, isn't he? In as much as he really does want to be involved. He wants to get into the war long before America's in the war.
That's exactly right. And there were a whole cadre of American volunteers who had gone over to France right the way from 1914 onwards, going to work in various guises, mainly as volunteer ambulance drivers or ambulanciers for the French army. Some had gone into a more active role, including as pilots. But he was very fixed. He was politically minded. His father, from back in the day, father had died by this stage, but his father had been a campaigning clergyman originally in New York and had known Theodore Roosevelt when Roosevelt was then the police commissioner for New York. And the man we're talking about, Arthur Clifford Kimber, he, in his California days, was very caught up in what was going on in Europe and the war, and was listening to what his hero, as he was politically and everything else, Theodore Roosevelt, thought about it, and thought that America really ought to be there. And when the opportunity presented itself to him, he took it.
Well, tell us a story then about this flag, this Stanford flag that somehow ends up being the very first American flag presented to a French army on French soil.
Well, it's just exactly 100 years ago that there's a large leave-taking ceremony, as it was called, in San Francisco in the Civic Auditorium there. Massive parade of cadets from both Stanford University and from Berkeley University, University of California, Berkeley. They met on the waterfront in San Francisco and marched to the auditorium. There, a number of flags, four flags in all, were presented that would be taken to France. And they were being taken to France by a group of these young volunteer ambulance students. And they were going over there ahead of the main army effort, because it would take quite some months to get the American Expeditionary Force together and the various troops booted, suited and trained and into combat. So he was determined, as a number of these other students were from Berkeley and from Stanford, to get over there. His flag, the Stanford flag, was designated with the help of the US Secretary of War to be the first official US government flag to travel to the front. And so a couple of days later, after this leave-taking ceremony, he set off on this, what was a long odyssey, by train across America. And then it was paraded down Fifth Avenue in New York, and then by armed steamship across the Atlantic. Quite nerve-wracking for him there, especially approaching the coasts of Britain, and eventually on through England to France and its presentation.
Was it a race? That's one of the things that he seems to get very het up about, that some people had the impression that he was actually in a race with the UC boys.
Well, the UC boys, they wanted to get ahead just as much as he did, and there was a little bit of almost like sibling rivalry, but it was the American Field Service were ultimately happy to see this flag go, and it was given the nod, and he was sent on ahead of his Stanford lot in order to achieve this.
And by the by, as he's coming over, he's a very good observer, and there's a touch, I think, of the early environmentalist about him. He talks about careless logging on the Continental Divide, all this timber just lying around there when he's passing through Montana, rotting away, and he's very unhappy about the rape of the American landscape as he sees it. He seems to be very ahead of his time.
There's so much of it that I thought was ahead of the time, and not just him, but his brother John. He had two brothers, but the elder one, John, and the younger one, George, he wanted to forge and his letters are littered with the grand plans, the dreams for after the war, as he hoped he would get to after the war. And that was to go into a form of scientific chicken farming and a new breeding methods that were kind of genuinely on the leading edge of genetic science then. And so ahead of his time, as you say, he had planned with his brothers to come back and do chicken farming back in California. In fact, in the end, of course, he never did return from Europe. He was killed in combat. But his brother John, the elder brother, actually did go into this chicken farming, and it turned into a multinational business.
On the boat, this St. Louis, there's all sorts of people, including this young woman who, after a couple of days, he's decided is a French professoress. She's going to teach him French. What happens, Patrick?
Well, I was rather sad for him at this point, because he thought he had cracked on to somebody who was very attractive to him, and he thought he was going to kill two birds with one stone, as you say, a French professoress, mm-hmm. possibly. He was very keen on improving his language skills. And so he went up, tried to chat her up in French, and the lady in question turned around and said, "I'm sorry, I haven't a clue what you're talking about. I don't speak any French." And at that point, he realised that she was the actress Lillian Gish, and who was at that stage on board, on her way over to film a D.W. Griffiths movie, Hearts of the World, which at that stage was just about to go into production as a propaganda war movie, and she was going over to film it in and around London.
The crossing is okay. They obviously, it's very nervous, isn't it, as they're coming close to Britain and coming through the Irish Sea on the way to Liverpool. They've got lots of protection from the German U-boats. So he comes to Liverpool, and in those days, I think arriving in Liverpool was tremendously impressive. And our man is certainly impressed, isn't he? Can you tell us what he wrote?
As you say, he comes in on this armed steamship, the St. Louis, and he is taken by the left and right, the Wirral Peninsula and Liverpool City, as he steams up the Mersey. So he writes, "Liverpool and the towns around it would be united if they were in America and called by some one name. But the English are great at keeping the old names. The right bank of the Mersey going up is residential, while most of the business is carried on in Liverpool. It presents a beautiful front to the traveller up the river. Fine red brick houses with blue slate roofs, all built to conform with each other and following one general artistic scheme, line the river for several miles. In front of them is a fine drive and then a magnificent beach. The whole is unmarred by railroads or any general traffic. The roofs of the houses are nearly all peaked, and each house has several very high and large chimneys. Few of the houses were more than that of three or four stories high. Just below this residential district, a fine light tower several hundred feet high and artistically proportioned. As I remember it, it was a very fine, large park. The red and blue colours of the houses blend nicely with the rich and verdant greens and give the whole a very pleasing effect. Above this district to the east was the town hall, a very fine building, very beautiful, and surrounded by magnificent lawns and now used as a hospital. One of the most striking things, though, was the visitor notices in the fine lawns and magnificent hedges, which are so lacking in America. Believe me, the whole south bank of the Mersey presents a beautiful sight and unmarred by any act of man. The only billboard that I saw there was one big one saying Spratt's Dog Biscuit, and it was a real blight to the otherwise fine effect."
When he gets to France, though, it seems to me, Patrick, he really is in a privileged position, isn't he? Because he isn't really with a unit. He's able, more or less, to freelance his way to the ambulance drivers, who are all volunteers, after all, and therefore are treated quite kindly by the French.
That's right. It's almost like a boy's own existence to begin with. It's almost like as if it's some glorified scout's mission. And they are serving these ambulance drivers with a unit of the French army. There were different ambulance units serving on the front at this time. Theirs was the largest of them, the American Field Service. And there would be units in each case of about 30 men, and they were men, parceled up across the front. And when he joined, there was a slight lull in the fighting. It was on, off, on, off. And their shifts were on, off, on, off. And so they would spend a lot of time in camps and whiling away the time, going swimming, doing whatever they could. His letters are full of the various pastimes that he was up to. But then suddenly it all clicks and they will have to drive, get the ambulance, drive to the front, and suddenly all of the skies will be lit up. The shells will be coming down and he will be there evacuating wounded French soldiers from the front.
He does hand over that flag, and there's a huge fuss made, isn't there?
There was, because to the French, and it wasn't just an American thing wanting to be seen to go over there, it was also a bit of a morale boost to the French and to others. And the photographs were reprinted in Paris in L'Illustration and here in London in the Daily Mirror. You know, Mr. Wilson sends the first flag to the front. It was a morale boost, and we know that it took the Americans quite some time to get a fully fledged, fully trained, fully equipped army into the field and then into the fighting proper. But at that stage in 1917, it was a shot in the arm.
So he writes, as we've said before, he writes like a journalist. And he writes stuff that I think a journalist would probably have had censored. He writes, for example, about the French Foreign Legion, and there's some very contentious stuff about how the French Foreign Legion fights in this hand-to-hand that was the end of trench warfare.
Yes, and one is never entirely sure exactly how much of this is real, so how much of it is exaggerated. I think it will be more towards the real scale as opposed to the exaggerated. But there's some grim accounts that were given to him of, you know, face-to-face butchery and of execution of prisoners. And it is borne out by studies that have been done by various people, including Neil Ferguson and Professor Joanna Burke, of the kind of fighting that did take place at the time. But French Foreign Legionnaires, they probably were going to be in the vanguard, shall we say, of some of the nastier fighting.
For one reason or another, you don't have the original letters, but was there any evidence of censorship?
He was aware that the censor's pen would be coming in, and so most of the time, actually only a handful of letters had words or sentences deleted. I think, and they were mainly in the earlier part when he was coming over across the sea from New York to Liverpool. But most of the time, he was self-censoring to one degree, and one degree only really, and that was he would use the first initial letter of a town or a city or a place or an area, wherever he was, and because he realised that the blue censor's pen would get that. But he was trying to skillfully not give away too much about actual military manoeuvres at any one specific time. And so for the large 99% part, he actually managed to escape the blue censor's pen.
He leaves the ambulance corps, he gets his wish, and he gets to join the Army Air Corps. And he gets to be quite good at it, doesn't he? He really gets to know these new planes, and his training results in some pretty interesting stuff.
Yes, I mean, he got itchy feet really quite quickly. He'd been over a matter of 2-3 months, and he managed then to effect a transfer. It took all of 4 months to actually get out and get into this service, the US Air Service, so a fledgling version of today's giant US Air Force. And but he had flown when he was a kid back in California. He was obsessed by flying. In fact, he on a family trip when he was a kid to France, he'd gone to Europe with his father and elder brother. Back in 1908, he'd actually seen Wilbur Wright demonstrating the Wright Model 1 aircraft, and he went back to California, and he started building all of these gliders and crashing in the Berkeley Hills. But so he can't wait when he's in France to get into the US Air Service, and he has great time trying out this, that, the other plane. But he's writing home, trying to make out to his mother and two brothers that, oh, it's all very normal and it's not at all dangerous. It's never mind about that, whatever. And it's terrifying, some of the detail that he's coming up with. And then gradually, over the time, you know, people to the left and people to the right of them are dying in training as this is happening. And he's trying to pull off all the manoeuvres he can, but he's trying to do so safely. And he's trying to, in his letter, say, look, there's a safe way to do this and an unsafe way to do this, and I'm going to be safe.
As you have said, and it's a sad truth, he doesn't make it home. He is brought down at the front. But before that, he loses one of his very best friends, doesn't he? And I think that suddenly seems to bring home the transience of life.
That's right. He had lost so many other people who he worked alongside, he trained alongside. They died here, they died there. And laterally, when he then got into the thick of it on the combat sphere. But yes, you're right. One particular friend, Alan Nichols, who he'd known from his Stanford days and who'd looked out for him and had helped him when they were in France at an early stage with the American Ambulance Field Service when he wasn't quite getting on with the rest of the lads. Alan was massively important. And Alan had served, actually, although he's an American, served with the French Air Service and in a unit that Arthur Clifford Kimber also briefly serves with. But he's killed, and he never saw him. He never saw him in this unit. He died just before Kimber arrived. And he read about him in the newspaper, and it was very shocking to him. But it seemed to give him an added impetus in those last months, in those last weeks. He called his plane Nick after Alan Nichols, and then there was a second Nick and a third Nick as various of them were shot up. And he was very determined that he was going to go out and avenge Alan's death.
You've mentioned that if he had come home, he might have gone into this very successful mass chicken farming. Do you ever think about him, when you've been living with him and his letters, do you ever wonder what else he might have achieved? He seemed to be a rather extraordinary young man.
I think he would have made a success with business with his brother, but ultimately he would have been a businessman. His brother was more of the scientist and more into the kind of agri-farming. I think that Arthur Clifford would have ended up probably branching out into his own line of whatever kind of commerce. I also think that he would have had a shot at public office. I think that his letters are, at least in part, he really did want to come back and write these letters up. And this is why I feel that we're in a lucky position to be able, 100 years on, to help him write these letters up. I think that he wanted to do the writing up of these letters because I think that he saw himself at some later stage in some kind of office of public life. I was struck by some of the colleagues that he would train with, and it was really quite binary that you read about this, that, or the other person who was 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, whatever. And it seemed to be quite binary. They either ended up becoming generals in later life or successful businessmen, or they died aged 20, 21. And sadly, Clifford was one of those.
There, but for the grace of God. Now, the book is called An American on the Western Front, The First World War Letters of Arthur Clifford Kimball from 1917 to 1918. And the author is Patrick Gregory. And if you want to find out more, Patrick's created a website, AmericanOnTheWesternFront.com. You can learn a lot more there about Arthur Clifford Kimball. And it's 3:30.